This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I'll go ahead and introduce our next speaker, who is Dr. Ann, Associate Professor, Occupational Recreational Therapies, Adjunct Associate Professor in Psychiatry at the University of Utah. Dr. Kirby will be talking about Aspire Autism Community Intervention for Suicide Prevention.
Yes, as John said, I'm going to talk about an autism community intervention that we've developed. I do this work in partnership with an organization called Aspire, which stands for the Academic Autism Spectrum Partnership in Research and Education, and that's based out of Portland State University. I have no disclosures, but I do want to thank my many collaborators, who include autistic adult community partners, clinicians, and mentors. And I've been supported in this research by the National Institute of Mental Health and a K23 award. But this is our Aspire Suicide Prevention Project team. So everything I'm talking about has been developed with this whole group. So I just want to make sure that they all get credit. Our team works over Zoom. So this is what we look like during our meetings. So I'll give you some background. So first, autism and suicide, is this really a problem? I've actually had clinicians who work in the field for a long time say that this isn't something that's really an issue in the autistic community. So I am here to tell you that would be kind of a myth or a misunderstanding from what we know. So some reasons that people think this might not be the case is these are myths. Autistic people don't have enough social awareness to be affected by those social risks for suicide, like bullying, exclusion, and loneliness. That's not true. Some people think that this is only relevant for, who might be considered quote unquote high functioning autistic folks. And we know that is not the case. It might be some folks might think that, we see autism more commonly diagnosed among males. And we also know from the suicide literature that males are more likely to die by suicide. And so I think some people want to combine those two things and say this is maybe particularly relevant for autistic men or boys. That is not the case. I'll talk about that. And then finally, I've had a lot of folks say to me, I don't work with adults. And so they think that suicide is really only an adult issue. And that is also not true. So I'll talk to you more about that. But I just want to get those myths out. And it's okay if you've thought them before, I'll talk to you today about what we do know. So suicide is a leading cause of early death in autistic population studies that have been done. Of course, many autistic people have not yet died. It's relatively early, like young diagnosis in the span of time. I did a study in Utah, a population-based study, where we found 1.5 times elevated relative risk of dying by suicide if you had an autism diagnosis. That's even less than what has been seen in European studies. So European studies have shown about 8 times the risk of suicide death. And so there's many reasons for that. I can talk about that later. But then interestingly, we've seen across both our study in Utah and several European studies that there is quite an elevated risk for autistic females compared to non-autistic females. And in particular, that it's roughly equal to the autistic males. So really, again, countering that myth I just shared that we should only be thinking about males. This is we want to think about the whole autistic community. We are also seeing, in addition to suicide deaths, suicidal thoughts, actions, and attempts that are really highly common. We're seeing data that shows autistic people of all genders, all racial and ethnic backgrounds, and across quite a wide age range. And so a study done here in the US found that parents were reporting over 35% of autistic children were reporting suicidal thoughts or behaviors before age 8. So again, this is not an adult issue. And studies that have looked at priorities, community priorities, have shown research on suicide risk and prevention is really a top priority of the community. So this is something that autistic people and their family members think is really important. So what do we know about suicide prevention program approaches? The World Health Organization says that suicide prevention should involve stakeholders from the outset and incorporate contextually relevant risk and protective factors. There's research on multi-level community-based interventions that are among the most promising avenues right now for suicide prevention. So we looked at what those multi-level community-based interventions could look like. And there's one program called PC Cares, which is an established education and community empowerment program that supports building communities of practice that are really going to continue working on suicide prevention. And they do that work in Alaskan Native communities focused on suicide prevention for Alaskan Native youth. And so tell you about our research project. So again, I do this work in partnership with Aspire that has been around for a while. We started our suicide prevention project team in 2022 with 7 autistic team members, come from multiple US states. People participate however they are able and comfortable. So some people speak, some people type, some people have communication supporters. And we're doing this, we do this whole study using a community-based participatory research approach and partnership. So everything we've done has been decided on as a team. So we first started with a qualitative study of 38 people that included autistic adults, mental health providers, and family members. And we used those interview findings as well as existing research and community knowledge to develop a new program that built on that PC Cares framework that I mentioned. So I just wanted to share this quote, just kind of speaking to the importance of this. One of our interview participants said, I'd say probably the number one thing that researchers should know about autism and suicide is that it's the rule rather than the exception. If an autistic adult isn't suicidal, then they're probably doing things to push it out of their mind because it's pretty much always there because we're constantly rejected. And they said that's especially true for people with multiple marginalized backgrounds, so queer and trans, autistic folks and autistic folks of color. So I'm not gonna get into detail in this presentation because I wanna focus on the intervention, but I did have a handout in the syllabus materials that you received that shows more about our thematic results from our interviews. But in summary, we mentioned pervasive negative societal attitudes and social experiences that have a lasting impact on autistic people's feelings of self-worth. That came up so much through all the interviews. Then on top of that, we learned about really negative experiences and stressors, which add strain, making life feel overwhelming and hopeless. And then on top of that, real difficulty regulating and managing kind of emotions and feeling really kind of volatile emotions, which then increases the likelihood of suicidal feelings and action. So that's a very brief summary of what we saw in our interviews. Okay, so our program development steps, we first received training and guidance about PC Cares from that team, which is led by Lisa Wexler at the University of Michigan. And they focus on the program, really emphasizes what do we know from research, but also giving the participants opportunities to really say, okay, well, what do we think about that? How does that apply to our community? And then what can we do about it? And so we gathered that, combined it with our interview results and other existing literature. And then with our whole team, engaged in a lot of brainstorming. A lot of time and energy went into really trying to make sure we were including the most kind of important things and supporting participants. And then we drafted plans and content, and we're currently testing. But I want to tell you about the program. So the program that we developed, we ended up naming Forming Love Around Autistic People to Prevent Suicide. And we ended up with this title really leaning back to that idea of that kind of negative societal treatment and daily stress and all these things. I feel like we really need to provide care and support to autistic people. And so really not making this a problem of the autistic person, but more of a community problem. That's why we're taking this community-based approach. So this is a drawing by an artist named Juliet Young. So I don't want to take credit for it, but she shared this, which just really this, when I saw this, it speaks a lot to what we're trying to do, which is not only think about autistic people who may be already experiencing suicidality, but try to go kind of further upstream and think about what we can do to help people prevent them from becoming suicidal. And so we're trying to think about the whole community and think about all the things that might contribute to suicide risk, rather than really viewing it as sort of a mental health problem that needs mental health treatment. We want to think about it as a really kind of holistic public health problem that needs really kind of comprehensive. And related to that, one of my mentors on this project is Dr. Craig Bryan. He's a suicide prevention expert at Ohio State. And he has a book in which he says, to do suicide prevention well, we have to do more than just stop people from dying. We have to create lives worth living. And so that's really gone into the work that we're doing in this program as well. So in terms of the details, we have focused on recruitment of community organizations that provide services, resources, and support for autistic people, as well as for families. And we're trying to think of, trying to include organizations, again, that aren't just working with adults, but maybe work with kind of any age, or working with groups that work with different age groups. But we felt like this was a good starting place because community organizations typically have multiple stakeholder types and are, we thought, fairly well positioned to serve as ongoing communities of practice. So they can work together, they can build suicide prevention, again, this really broad perspective of suicide prevention, into all of their work. And so we ended up with a program that includes four virtual sessions. And so we cover the topics, which I'll talk about, as well as, again, we want to do this community empowerment, and we want them to move forward with this work. So we have a lot of group discussion where they can think about what actions their organization can take to support suicide prevention. So we really want it to be interactive. And these are 2-hour sessions that we schedule biweekly so that they have kind of time to think about and integrate things as well. Some principles of our program are that suicide prevention takes community efforts, that it's much more than crisis support. So crisis support is important, but it's not the only way to do suicide prevention. Again, we want to prevent people from getting to that point. We need to consider multiple approaches to suicide prevention. So really thinking about multiple levels of prevention from a public health perspective. So suicide prevention for the people currently experiencing suicidality, suicide prevention for people at risk, and then suicide prevention for the whole community, particularly we're focusing on autistic people, but really trying to make sure we're thinking about everyone to try to take that broad perspective. And really, an important principle is that suicide prevention can be part of the work of community organizations. So that is why we're kind of focusing there. And we think groups that are doing many different kinds of community work can build suicide prevention in ways that work for their community. So for this program and the way we've organized it, it's really based on multiple layers of suicide prevention. And this came out of the interviews that we did and the existing data. And this was a helpful way for us to organize kind of how we're thinking about addressing suicide prevention in those kind of different ways, addressing people currently at risk all the way to kind of thinking about the whole community. With, again, the overarching goal really to be supporting safe, healthy, and meaningful lives. So again, that idea of lives worth living and not just stopping people from ending their life, but really trying to support suicide prevention from that broad lens. So we've created this multi-layered approach, which aligns really well with sort of socio-ecological perspectives. And we start from the outside and work inward as the program goes along. So I'll talk now about what we cover in the different aspects of the program. So in that first layer, that outer layer, societal attitudes and culture, the main idea of what we're discussing in the session is that we want to improve attitudes about autism. So we introduce the concept of neurodiversity, and we outline what we've called a classical perspective of autism, which may align with any of folks have probably heard the term medical model. But really thinking about autism as something that needs to be kind of fixed or cured versus what we've labeled as in this program, an evolving perspective. So that really supports neurodiversity and the idea that people do need support, but they need individual support that aligns with their goals. And so we talk about the relationship here between discrimination and mental health problems. And so how stigma and discrimination of autistic people connects with suicide risk. And we also talk about how research shows that suicidality is associated with feeling like a burden and feeling like you don't belong. And we've seen that for decades in the general population, but we've also seen that in autism samples. And so it's really important to think about kind of those perspectives of how society is treating autistic people. And then in this first session, we cover you know, some heavier topics as well. So dehumanization practices and institutionalization, forced sterilization, filicide, and torture. All of those things are hard to hear about and think about, but these have all been perpetuated against disabled people, including autistic people, and really connect with this idea of how kind of societal thinking and stigmas can really trickle down to affect individual people. And then in the session, we really want to focus on, okay, well, then what can we do about that? How can we change societal attitudes and culture? And so some ideas from our team are about acceptance of differences, you know, that kind of neurodiversity acceptance, autonomy, so supporting access to communication, promoting self-determination. We're thinking about safety and comfort, so having kind of physical safety as well as safety in social environments and relationships. And then finally, you know, creating opportunities for possibilities to explore interests and passions, to develop new skills, and to see other autistic people thriving through representation. So those are things we cover in this outer layer of our model. At that second layer, which was services, supports, and resources, the main idea is that we cover is to increase access to services and resources that effectively meet autistic people's needs. This may seem like a very general thing, but again, if we have these unmet needs, research shows that unmet needs are associated with suicidality for autistic people. And so these daily life challenges, these unmet needs can lead to burnout and suicidality. And so how can we go again upstream and make sure people are getting the appropriate resources and supports that they need to function in their daily lives? And that's part of suicide prevention. So we talk specifically about the importance of individualized, trauma-informed, and adaptable services that are aimed at supporting kind of a variety of needs. But we talk specifically about communication, about sensory supports, skill development, daily life and basic needs, physical health. We heard a lot in our interviews about pain conditions, autoimmune conditions, and other physical health things that really chronic conditions that contribute to kind of these daily life challenges and burnout and unmet needs. And then finally, mental and emotional health, which again, I said suicide prevention isn't all mental health care, but it is an important piece of it. And so during this session, we have teams engage in a resource mapping activity to really think about what the resources are in their own community. And identify resources and services that also may not exist, so they can raise awareness or potentially help close gaps for the autistic people in their organization or in their kind of service area, the people they serve. The next layer is social network and community. This is so important. So the main idea here is that we really want to have the participants in the program think about how to connect with, support, and validate autistic people in their lives, in their organizations, in their service kind of networks. One thing that came up that is kind of a key idea is include autistic people in their own social networks. So thinking about, you know, if you're only serving autistic people, but you're not kind of integrated, you don't have autistic people in your life in another way. What is that? How might that kind of limit social networks? Really understanding that social supports and social networks are important, but that autistic people may have different socialization needs and they can change. So lots of people in the interviews talked about kind of particular needs that work for them. So just having like hang sessions, where it's often described as kind of some of the worst things they like. Many people talked about needing some more structure, like getting together to play a game or trivia or some kind of activity. But really thinking about ways that these participants in our program that work, these organizations can support and connect with autistic people, and thinking really broadly about that. So not forgetting about the non-speaking community, autistic people with co-occurring intellectual disability, and other kind of more marginalized members of the community as well. And really the importance of validation for struggles that folks face. We heard a lot about people who really just felt like no one believed them, no one listened to them. And actually the interviews that I was able to do seemed like in some ways just a really important opportunity for folks to just be able to be heard. We can do that kind of in our social networks, in our communities as well. But yeah, we talk about the evidence of suicidality is associated with those social factors I mentioned earlier, like loneliness, isolation, bullying, and abusive relationships. And in this session, we also share a video that was created by one of our non-speaking team members to talk about their unique challenges and the importance of social networks and supports for non-speaking people as well. Again, not forgetting about those members of the community. And then finally, our layer four content is that individual level. And so we've kind of drilled down, and we really want people to think about planning ahead for safety and support during difficult times. So these are the people who are maybe at the most short-term risk of suicide. So it's helpful to be aware of risk factors and warning signs. We also talk about individual differences and sort of caveats to risk factors and warning signs. in your materials, I also have a handout from our program that kind of shows the content there, because that may be helpful to you all. We also talk about how suicidality is not always a yes or no question. So, are you experiencing suicidality? Yes or no? People may experience different degrees of suicidal thinking and actions at different times, but lots of autistic people can feel some degree of sort of chronic suicidality. So suicidality that sort of persists or kind of goes in waves over time. And in this session, we also talk about the challenges of communicating about suicide, but also the importance of having conversations and believing autistic people when they tell you what they're experiencing. Many of our interview participants had shared about how they sort of learned through social experiences that they shouldn't talk about suicidality because of the way that people around them had reacted when they had tried. And so really, like, part of this program, we really want to get kind of awareness and understanding that we don't want to tell people those are bad things and we can't talk about them, because they're still going to feel them. And so giving them opportunities to be listened to and to be able to listen and provide support to people. And then we talk about safety planning. So really, again, thinking about short-term needs. So how to make environments safer, helping people think about maybe some, what are their reasons for living? What are some things they can look forward to in the short term, or things that they have that might help them kind of hang on? What their unique coping and distraction techniques may be, what their unique resources may be that could be helpful to them, and what their social supports and networks can be. And then finally, in our program, we kind of try to pull it all together and think about multiple levels. But in that multi-level conversation, we talk about how critical it is to have access to rights and resources to live, legal rights, food, clothing, and shelter, financial security, healthcare, really thinking back to that, that drawing from Juliet Young again, with the river and the bridge, and really thinking about what we need to kind of support people to live well. And then finally, we talk to organizations about how they might want to prepare in advance for responding to a suicide event that might happen in their community. So, and that's considered postvention is the word used for that. And so we have organizations start to think about, you know, we're talking about prevention, but how can we also kind of prepare in advance to support people if someone in the community does die by suicide, or there's another suicide-related event? So that was a really quick overview of, like I said, what we cover in about 8 hours, four 2-hour sessions. So we're currently piloting the program, gathering data about its impact, getting feedback from participants. So far, we've delivered the program to 7 different organizations, and that's included a variety of different kinds of organizations, so state-level offices, advocacy organizations, and service providers. And participants have included organization staff. We've had some who are autistic people, some family members, some clinicians, et cetera. So lots of different kind of types of participants and different backgrounds and kind of engagement with the community. And the program is facilitated by me and 2 autistic professionals from our team. So in conclusion, suicide prevention is really important for the autistic community. I hope I conveyed that to you. Negative societal attitudes, ongoing stressors, and difficulty with emotions can all contribute to suicidality. And so we're really trying to think about autism-specific supports, but also thinking about how we can all play a role in supporting prevention. So again, not really thinking of this as a mental health service problem specifically, but thinking about what anyone can do to support people at maybe those from those different levels that I discussed. And yeah, our team has developed this 4-part virtual training, which we're currently pilot testing. We're hoping it will empower organizations and the people that work within them to incorporate this broad-based suicide prevention approach into their ongoing work. And we've had like a really positive reception so far. So it's been a great opportunity, and we're excited to see how many organizations are passionate about moving forward with this. So I'll end there, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kirby, and not only for the content, but for modeling how we can live our values around the social value, the social model of disability, that it's not just focused on changing the person with pills or procedures, but also improving their social and physical environment. And that is something that doesn't take government resources necessarily, and that we can all have a part in preventing suicide in our communities and strengthen our connections to each other, which I think we all are suffering from a lack of after years of COVID. So this is very hopeful, and I love the idea that the fact that you pulled from an intervention designed by Native Alaskans and applied it to this population, because it makes the parallels from other communities that that may need to access medical care in different ways. So kudos to you. It's fantastic work and fantastic community organizing. In terms of questions, how might a provider adjust their suicide risk assessment questions for autistic people?
Yeah, that's a great question. So just maybe some examples that I can share is sometimes the wording is taken quite literally. And so we've heard of situations where, you know, the question is, are you feeling suicidal right now? And someone may say no, but they may be planning to attempt suicide later that day. And so really trying to think very specifically about the words that are being asked, and in a way that I think as providers, if you have a relationship with someone, kind of understanding how they communicate and what those best needs are. And I think it also may be helpful. So we hear a lot about fear in the community about what's going to happen if they say yes to a question about suicidality. And so I think having a lot of transparency or clarity about what you would do with information that you get, because like I said, people will often, autistic people may have been taught over time that when I tell someone how I'm really feeling, they get upset, or they tell me I'm wrong, or they have a reaction that ends up harming me more. I have a colleague named Lisa Morgan, who does a lot of speaking on this topic, and she uses a phrase a lot that she feels she's experienced a lot and sees a lot of unintentional harm. And so, you know, I just really caution folks to be really mindful of what you're doing may have good intentions, but it could end up harming people. And so being really open to hearing what people are really thinking and having transparency about what you may have to do with information that you get. I know many people are restricted kind of by law and how they, you know, if they hear certain words, they have to respond in a certain way. And that can over time have kind of pretty negative responses from folks in the community. And so I think to build trust and have trusting relationships, those are some things that I can think of. But yeah, lots of, you know, because there's sometimes a literal way of kind of thinking and processing the specific way questions are asked, can need to be tailored for individual people, and sometimes our specific screeners don't work. There's a lot of work happening, teams trying to adapt different screening tools, and so we may see more of that coming out over the next several years, I'm hoping, tools that have been developed and edited with autistic input and contributions, because right now I think there are some limitations.
Excellent. Do you have any recommendations for books or materials to talk with young children about suicide?
Wow, that is a great question. I can't think of anything right now. I will think more about it. And then there is a group that, a national work group that exists that has some tools for autistic adults, and they've been involving pediatric providers to think about how to adapt them for youth. And so I'm hoping, again, some things may come out about that, but I can't think of any existing off the top of my head, sorry. But great, that would be great.
So I have a question about your program, and I hope, Clarissa, if you had already asked this question, then please disregard. Okay. But you talked about four sessions of 2 hours each as a preventive program. And I'm wondering if that's just the beginning. In other words, it seems relatively short, and maybe reminders and sort of further preparation, or I guess therapy, might be helpful, but I'm wondering
So the program is for community organizations who are going to embed suicide prevention efforts like into their ongoing work. So it's not 8 hours of individual treatment or therapy. Certainly people likely will need more. We are currently, after our four sessions, we're getting follow-up information from the participants. And then 3 months later, we're following up with them again. So we're just currently following up with our first group right now after 3 months. They finished 3 months ago. And so we'll have some information about, like, we're asking them, are there things that you feel like you need? Would it, you know, do they need some kind of follow-up or refreshers, or would it be more helpful if the program was more spread out? PC Cares has previously done monthly, but we were worried we may sort of lose people if it's too spread out. So, but yeah, great question. And as we're in the pilot phase, we're thinking about that sort of thing and what, if this is the right sort of dosage of educational intervention.
Another question came in. What's your experience with the level of awareness of ASD with the 988 hotline call operators?
That is a great question, and it varies hugely by location. So 988 routes you to usually a local operator, a local call center. And so, you know, I know that all of the calls here in Utah go to just up the street from me. And those folks have at least some training in autism, and we've talked to them about it. And I know it's on their radar. Whereas I've spoken to autistic people who've called, you know, in different states and had quite different experiences, and sometimes quite negative. And so we do kind of want to raise awareness among all call centers. And so, again, I mentioned before my colleague Lisa Morgan, she has a website, I think it's autismcrisissupport.com, and I can type it in the chat after I'm done speaking, but she has some interesting resources on there. One of them is information for crisis call workers. So if you're connected with crisis centers at all, sharing some of that information could be helpful. And then she and I was part of this as well, work to make just an information sheet about 988 for autistic people so that they can learn kind of what to expect And on that sheet, we acknowledge that you may not have a positive experience. It may not provide the service that you're looking for. And I also just want to mention, there are also warm lines, which I think a lot of people don't know about, but there's a website, I believe it's warmline.org. Again, I can type it in the chat, but that's staffed by mental health peers. And so people who've experienced mental health challenges themselves. So they may not be autistic, but you may get, people may get a different kind of reception and ability to talk to someone at a warm line as opposed to 988. So I just want to make sure people are aware of those as resources as well.
Wonderful. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, maybe this will be the last question. It's a little bit long, but I think it really addresses some of the key issues that you've talked about. So I know you mentioned your interviews had a common theme of negative experiences and needing acceptance. I was wondering if those interviews also included themes of autistic burnout from trying to fit into a world designed for neurotypical people, rather than being free to be their authentic selves. And was there any feedback from your interviews on whether ABA therapy had been helpful or not?
Right. Okay. So yeah, so definitely burnout came out, but not as a reason people experience suicidality, but the reason they're experiencing burnout is also a reason they may experience suicidality. So just a little bit removed. So it's these daily challenges, these unmet needs, the sort of regular just stressor after stressor after stressor can contribute to burnout. And people also talk about those things contributing to suicidality. And so it's not the burnout itself, I think, that's related to suicidality, but those kind of regular challenges and those daily stressors. And then remind me the second, that was the last piece that I
heard. Was there interview feedback from your interviews on whether ABA therapy has been helpful or not?
So no, ABA didn't come up a lot, but something I think is really important is that some ABA services can contribute to the kind of pressure to kind of conform to neurotypical standards. And people talked about those pressures being problems for them. So people telling them, they can't stim and they can't flap, they can't, you know, they have to make eye contact, they have to do other things like that. So if to the extent that there are services that are targeting those kinds of goals, those can contribute to suicidality according to our interviews. But people also talk about the need for services and resources. And so So having individualized services that are addressing goals that are important to people, that have meaning, that aren't focused on them fitting in, but on them being able to kind of be successful in their lives in ways that work with their autistic characteristics and, you know, aren't trying to sort of restrict their comfort, not trying to take away their sensory supports. Those services are needed. And so we don't have specific results about ABA, but I just want to make that clarification that ABA is a big umbrella and it can really depend on what it looks like.
Well, thank you so very much for an amazing talk. And thank you again.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at UCTV.tv.